This is the Takeaway Podcast for Thursday, August 6th, 2015. This is the Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. It's a signal of our times, perhaps, that as Big Shot Network anchor Brian Williams slinks back to cable news this month, a giant of cable says goodbye tonight, taking with him the credibility, stature, journalistic integrity, and power to change the national discourse that today's network anchors can only dream of, and that is associated with the likes of David Brinkley, Walter Cronkite, Peter Jennings, and Edward R. Murrow. He is, of course, the very laughable Jon Stewart.
Welcome. Welcome, welcome to The Daily Show. Craig Kilborn is on assignment in Kuala Lumpur. I'm Jon Stewart. Coming up on today's show, Stephen Colbert with the latest analysis out of Washington. Beth Littleford interviews the original Munchkins. And Michael J. Fox is my first guest, and he's a nice man for doing it. But first, let the healing begin. It's headlines.
The year was 1999, and an impeached President Bill Clinton was in office when Jon Stewart took over the reins of The Daily Show. Clinton and his congressional enemies made for a comedy goldmine.
You're out of order. He's out of order. This whole trial is sexy. President Clinton's historic impeachment trial begins Thursday, and the most important issue facing the United States Senate is how can it take a pointless, tawdry trial, whose outcome has already been decided, and make it last six hilarious, humiliating months.
But Stewart found comedy in more than just Bill Clinton, and he goes out tonight with Donald Trump leading the field of GOP presidential candidates, something Stewart's writers couldn't have dreamed of 16 years ago. In the intervening years, Stewart's Daily Show has grown to be the it place to be seen, smeared, pilloried, held accountable, and even celebrated sometimes.
Mr. Bill O'Reilly!
Senator Elizabeth Warren!
Tim Geithner!
Mike Huckabee!
President Bill Clinton!
King Abdullah II!
Christine Lagarde!
President Barack Obama!
Let's go!
Peter Munsing in Wyonissing, Pennsylvania will certainly miss him. John, you got people interested in governance to think about policy and society and more than stereotypes, to consider humor rather than anger, and to ask questions about soundbite media. And you'll always have our respect for the care and respect you gave to your work by not going shallow, for having humor that is considered. Stewart's fusing of entertainment and news did the opposite of dumbing down and sexing up the criticism of the mainstream news media, as Stewart, the growth of the internet, and even Fox News showed that with a point of view, audiences got a fresh interest in current events. Brooke Gladstone, host of On the Media, says what Stewart said at the peak of his power could not be ignored by politicians, corporations, and other powerful figures in American civic life.
When there was the famous poll among millennials that determined that Jon Stewart was the most trusted man in television, well, compare him to an earlier poll in the 70s when Walter Cronkite was, and you see there's a sensibility there that really changed, and it changed because of the internet, where being objective and speaking from on high now became unworthy of trust, whereas being down to earth and expressing what you really felt built trust. And that's a totally different paradigm.
Stewart also understood how people absorb the news in a way that traditional media outlets, I don't think, understood at all. He would always say that, I'm not a news source because people who are getting the news from me don't laugh at my jokes. They have to know the news already before they laugh. So he understood that people were absorbing news in ways that had nothing to do with the networks anymore, through the internet and other places. And by the time they got to his show, they were ready to use the news, and comedy became a way for people to use the news. It was an empowering mechanism as well as just entertainment.
I agree with everything you just said, except that I think he was being a little disingenuous when he said his audience already knew the news. I think some of it did, but I think a good percentage, including many stories I myself first learned from his show, and I pay attention to the news, happened because of the way he conveyed it. And I think when he understood that, he stopped saying, hey, you know, I'm just a comedy guy, I'm just a joke guy. And he started leveraging his position and this unique amalgamation to influence policy, and he did.
Well, in a couple of very celebrated ways, he did that. After 9/11, of course, he had a very particular sort of talk to the nation.
The main reason that I wanted to speak tonight is not to tell you what the show's going to be, not to tell you about all the incredibly brave people that are here in New York and in Washington and around the country. But we've had an unenduring pain here, and unendurable pain. And I wanted to tell you why I grieve.
During the Brian Williams scandal, I remember a very particular talk to the nation. We compare Brian Williams' crimes with the crimes of the Bush administration in Iraq.
Finally, someone is being held to account for misleading America about the Iraq war.
And the media's ignoring of those lies that took place.
Right.
And he had the
wonderful
standing
perspective there. But I'm talking about things like mismanagement of the Veterans Administration.
So over veterans isn't a bug of the program. It's a feature of the program. They took a program that, by all rights, should cost $50 billion to really help people and got it down to $10 billion by just taking out the people it could help.
Things that actually influenced effects, maybe even policies on the Hill.
Guess what, folks? Not 6 hours after we aired that damning piece of investigative jokalism, the VA folds.
Officials say they're relaxing a rule that makes it hard for some veterans in rural areas to prove they live at least 40 miles from a VA health site. The change now measures the trip by driving miles rather than as the crow flies.
In that sense, is he just more like a traditional columnist in the sense that Walter Winchell would go be outraged by something and something would change? That's his most traditional role, being kind of an outraged columnist
but
who also gets laughs.
That's the amalgamation I'm talking about, because Walter Winchell never got laughs intentionally, as far as I know, whereas Jon Stewart used the laughter to create change. And it isn't, it's, I mean, comics have done that for a long time. I mean, there have been lots of political comics who want to affect change. But Jon Stewart was something else because he kept introducing information. And he was also, I think, his biggest legacy as a hypocrisy watcher. I always imagine thousands of interns looking at decades of tape in order to find the exact moment when a politician, or many moments when politicians say one thing and then the opposite thing a year, 2 years, 3 months later.
One group in particular, very upset about the influence that money has on our politics.
We must reduce the role of money in politics.
Stem the corrosive influence of money in politics.
The corrupting influence of money.
The unending chase for money threatens to steal our democracy itself.
But the Democrats are outraged, and their outrage is brought to you by money. There's only one problem.
In the 10 Senate races where the most outside money's been spent, liberal groups have outspent conservatives $97 million to $79 million.
There are states where the Democrats are outspending 5 or 10 to 1.
Democrats have realized these are the rules of the game, as much as they profess not to like them.
One of those, thou shalt not kill, but if you're going to. Single shot, back of the head, you want a carbon steel hacksaw, then put the parts in several trash bags, spread them out over a forest.
Let's talk a little bit about some of the maybe negative stories that have come out as Jon Stewart's departure approaches. A discussion about the depiction of Herman Cain in the editorial sort of comedy writer's world of The Daily Show became a very bitter fight between an African-American writer and Jon Stewart.
Bills will be 3 pages. If I am president, treaties will have to fit on the back of a cereal box. From now on, the State of the Union address will be delivered in the form of a fortune cookie. I am Herman Cain, and I do not like to read.
Does that say something about the editorial process? Does it say something about Jon Stewart? Does it say something about, you know, something we don't know about The Daily Show?
I don't know what it says, frankly. It could be one writer who was really offended by Jon Stewart making funny voices about people. And certainly he makes funny voices about everybody. I mean, especially comics do that. And comics expect to be able to transgress. But when you're in a position of such influence, then that freedom gets diminished. And I think that's what happened in that case. But I don't know what to think. Wyatt Cenac, they've had lots of writers since the days when they were criticized for being purely white Jewish writers.
They've been pretty white though, all along.
Well, they've made a real effort to diversify the on-air team, and I think that they've been responsive to it. you start worrying too much about how you make a joke and whether you set a different standard for one kind of a joke or another, and it impedes your movement. So I don't know how to criticize or even assess what happened in that situation.
But you interviewed Stewart before he started.
Yes,
on
I
the
did.
Big show.
I did. I made fun of him.
Yeah.
He was just about to take this new job
right.
after having been passed over for a bunch yeah. of other jobs. And, you know, we talked about his aspirations. And I think maybe one of the most interesting things, he said that when he was asked what was the most important thing he'd accomplished so far in his life, had he accomplished anything, he said, I got out of New Jersey.
Somebody asked me the other day, they said, do you feel like you've done anything great? I said no. And then I thought, no, I have. And the one thing I did that was great was I moved from Trenton, New Jersey to New York to try and become a comedian. That's the one thing I've done in this business that's great. Because I gave myself the opportunity to express whatever it was that I thought I needed to express.
And I think that, you know, there he was on the verge of The Daily Show. And I can't imagine how many times he had to stare down fears of new challenges. But he went ahead and he forged a whole new path.
But he said, you know, all those things I really wanted to do, I did them before The Daily Show. So a lot of icing on that cake post-Daily Show.
I guess it must be fun to be Jon Stewart.
Brooke Gladstone, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Brooke Gladstone is host of WNYC's On the Media. We polled a few powerful Republicans on Capitol Hill about Jon Stewart's departure and legacy and got a mixed message.
Gee, we're going to miss you, buddy.
No, you're not.
My other comment, I guess, is there's an old country and western song, Thank God and Greyhound, he's gone.
I haven't bothered to watch.
Republican Senators John Thune, John McCain, and John Cornyn.
This is Jack in Boston. I was just thinking, wow, we all get our news from Comedy Central and our laughs from Fox News. What on earth will we do now to get some clear and genuine content?
I guess you'll just have to fall back on public radio, folks. We're not going anywhere. And on The Takeaway, we have moments of zen every day, sometimes more than one.
Support for The Takeaway comes from Lumosity, introducing a 10-minute fit test to challenge memory, attention, and problem-solving with brain games to calculate baseline scores and build a personalized brain training program. Performance can be compared to global averages. Learn more at Lumosity.com.
This week, a federal appeals court panel ruled that a Texas voter ID law was discriminatory in violation of the 1965 Voting Rights Act. The Texas law required voters to bring government-issued photo ID to the polls like a driver's license or a U.S. passport, a rule that the plaintiffs in the suit argued unfairly limited the ability of poor people and minorities to vote. Joining me now is Wendy Weiser, director of the Democracy Program at the Brennan Center for Justice at New York University School of Law. Her organization helped represent some of the plaintiffs in this suit. Wendy, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
So you have a dog in this fight, so I gather you're celebrating a little bit here.
Oh, we are delighted. This is a real victory for Texas voters. The more than 600,000 Texas voters that the federal court found do not currently have photo IDs that would have been accepted under the very strict photo ID law that Texas had passed and that is now found to be discriminatory.
Is this a signal that voter ID laws, which have become more popular since the Shelby County ruling, which really changed our whole view of the Voting Rights Act, are going to be more viewed with more suspicion, are going to be subject to more challenge, or it's going to change the way in which these laws are written because of this decision?
Well, it's important to note that this decision does not invalidate all voter ID laws. It was a very specific law in Texas that was widely acknowledged as the most restrictive law in the nation. There are a lot of voter ID requirements across the country that are not under scrutiny, that people are not challenging. What was wrong with Texas's law is that it sharply limited the number of IDs that people could have to a small number that many, many Texans did not have, and that, in fact, fell disproportionately on minorities and poor people in the state.
Is it the view of the Brennan Center and the view of the plaintiffs in this case, and possibly even the appeals court, that voter ID laws are being viewed as a mechanism for disenfranchising voters, as opposed to simply, you know, requiring an administrative, detail that people would present at the time that they vote?
You know, that was certainly the case with the particular law at issue here. Nobody is taking issue with voter ID laws in general. There are many voter ID requirements in place across the country that are reasonable requirements that have a wider range of IDs or that have some kind of mechanism for the people that don't have acceptable IDs to demonstrate their identity and vote. That was not the case in Texas. And the important thing, and this is one of the important features of the Voting Rights Act, is you need to look at the particulars of the requirements. The history of voting discrimination in the country is putting in place requirements that may look reasonable on their face, but in their particulars operate to discriminate against particular groups. Here, you know, this is a law that allowed for concealed carry licenses to be used as ID for voting, but didn't allow for government-issued student IDs, government-issued employment IDs. It was very cherry-picked which kind of IDs could use based on, who had those IDs.
And so the court seems to suggest that this particular law was more reminiscent of the poll tax kind of approach, the quizzes that were used for voters in the 20th century that were very much the motivation for the Voting Rights Act to begin with.
Yeah, the lower court had in fact found that the law was passed with the purpose of discriminating against minority voters in the state. The court didn't uphold that yet. It sent it back to reconsider that ruling. But the court did find that the law had the result of discriminating against minorities in the state, that it interacted with other social circumstances and discrimination in the state to make it harder for minority voters to participate in the political process, just like poll taxes did in the past. Mm-hmm.
Given the politicization of the federal judiciary, is it significant that this decision came out of the Texas, the southern region?
You know, actually, it not only came out of the Fifth Circuit in the Southern region, but the decision itself was penned by an appointee of George W. Bush. Some of the decisions in the past have been broken down along partisan lines based on who appointed the judges. Here, there was clear consensus. It was a 3-0 decision that this law was discriminatory. It violated the Voting Rights Act. They crossed a line.
So 50 years after the Voting Rights Act was passed, which is a celebration today, this decision suggests that the pendulum is not swinging entirely the other way since the Shelby decision. Is there room for advocates of voting rights and people who are concerned about erosion of the Voting Rights Act to feel better today?
Well, there's certainly room to feel happy that even in its current weakened form, the Voting Rights Act does have teeth. It can be used to stop discriminatory voting laws. But again, it is a much more weakened form. You have to keep in mind, this is the third time a federal court found that this very voter ID law that Texas passed was discriminatory. And the law has still been in place in 4 elections in Texas. Before the Supreme Court had gutted the core provision of the Voting Rights Act, these laws would have not gone into effect. This law would have had to be approved by the federal government before Texas could implement it. And the federal government actually, before the Shelby County decision, rejected this law. And it was blocked. So this is it is a bittersweet ruling because for the last several elections, there are 600,000 or more Texans who had an illegal burden on their right to vote that they had to contend with.
Wendy Weiser is director at the Democracy Program at the Brennan Center for Justice at New York University School of Law. The Brennan Center helped represent some of the plaintiffs in the lawsuit that struck down the Texas voter ID law this week. Thanks so much.
Thank you for having me.
Support for The Takeaway comes from TIAA CREF, a financial services company helping to create financial outcomes that matter. Learn more at TIAA.org.
The first use of nuclear weapons took place 70 years ago today by the United States. It was intentional. It was the dawn of a new age and the dawn of a new age of military mythology. Here's President Harry Truman, who learned about the secret existence of U.S. nuclear weapons only after FDR suddenly died and he was sworn in as president.
The world will note that the first atomic bomb was dropped on Hiroshima, a military base.
But Hiroshima was no military base. And the first atomic bomb was developed to stop Hitler, not Japan. Once the U.S. had the bomb, though, the U.S. decided it was a necessary step to end the Second World War. The dual attacks on Hiroshima and Nagasaki 3 days later killed at least 129,000 people, most of them civilians, further devastating a Japan already in flames.
It felt as though the bomb had fallen directly on us. It reminded me of something I had read as a boy, a large meteor colliding with the Earth.
My sister and I were 2,000 yards away. My sister seemed quite normal during and after the blast, but a week later, she became sick and suddenly died. Doctor said it was radiation.
Eyewitnesses to the horrors of the nuclear age just beginning. Today, nuclear weapons are both much more sophisticated and deadly and deployed for vastly different reasons than in 1945. Nearly 16,000 nuclear weapons are in the arsenals of 9 countries around the world. Eric Schlosser, author of Command and Control, Nuclear Weapons, The Damascus Accident, and The Illusion of Safety, says the nuclear threat is still as deadly, but has lost its urgency, a fact Schlosser says we should all be worried about.
I think that nuclear weapons are the greatest national security threat that we face, and we must be deeply concerned about the proliferation of these weapons. I think the Iran deal must, you know, succeed, and we must prevent any other countries from getting these weapons, especially today when you have ideologies in the world that are celebrating the slaughter of civilians, celebrating the destruction of cultural monuments that date back centuries. Every one of those nuclear weapons is an accident waiting to happen. Sadly, these weapons have been largely forgotten in the United States. I grew up in the 70s and 80s, where it was something that people thought about every day, and I don't have nostalgia for that period. But what's remarkable today is the historical amnesia about all aspects of nuclear weapons.
And if we were to take a look at the history of the nuclear systems in the world, we really learn a very, very scary series of stories of near misses and, you know, 6-minute decisions. Run down the timeline of some of the scary moments that Americans have virtually no memory of.
It was quite astonishing to learn how close we came to losing American cities to our own nuclear weapons during accidents, and also how close we came to an all-out nuclear war with the Soviet Union. This information was denied during the Cold War, and it's only since the early 1990s that the documents have been declassified and that the officials are willing to speak on the record about how close we came. And this is a very difficult technology to manage. I mean, during the Cuban Missile Crisis, you know, there were all kinds of ways that a nuclear war could have occurred just because there were so many weapons and so many individual local commanders who were authorized to use them without having to contact the head of either country. In my book, I also look at one accident in Damascus, Arkansas, at some length, that could have detonated a huge thermonuclear warhead. It would have destroyed much of the state of Arkansas, contaminated large areas of the eastern seaboard, and may have killed Bill Clinton, who was the young governor of Arkansas at the time.
Our understanding of the actual use of nuclear weapons at the end of World War II is also not very accurate. I mean, if you look at the details of why we used bombs in Japan on Nagasaki and Hiroshima, strategically, if we were to look back today, there wasn't a reason necessarily to use either of those, and the harm was mostly to civilians. There's a decent argument to be made that it was a war crime as much as it was a strategic end to World War II.
You know, it's a subject surrounded by enormous controversy, and I think it was a war crime in the sense that we killed hundreds of thousands of innocent civilians, and not just in Hiroshima and Nagasaki. We destroyed dozens of Japanese cities with firebombs, deliberately. At the same time, these actions have to be viewed in context. The Japanese killed between 10 to 30 million civilians in China. They killed 1 million Chinese civilians with biological and chemical weapons, and it was a very ugly war. There were many people at the time in the military who thought we could have defeated Japan without using atomic weapons, but they were arguing that we should continue firebombing them. So the importance of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, to me, beyond the needless death of the victims there, is those bombings offer a harbinger of what warfare could look like in the future. It's just, it's mind-boggling, the devastation that occurred. There have been studies recently that show that if India and Pakistan engaged in a small nuclear exchange, using 100 nuclear weapons or 150, a billion people could die. Now, I'm not apocalyptic, having done all this research. I don't lie in bed at night worrying it's going to happen, but I am concerned. I am concerned about the possibility of terrorist groups getting one of these weapons.
Finally, are we going to coexist with nuclear weapons? Do people have a 100 years out look at where nuclear weapons will be?
You know, people hugely disagree. There are some people who believe that nuclear weapons guarantee that nations won't fight major wars against one another anymore. And that logic is true until it isn't. I think it's miraculous that no city has been destroyed by a nuclear weapon since 1945. As long as they exist somewhere in the world, I think there's a huge chance that one of them will go off and hurt other people.
Eric Schlosser, author of Command and Control, Nuclear Weapons and the Damascus Accident and the Illusion of Safety. Thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
Support for The Takeaway comes from Curious.com, committed to helping people learn more than 15,000 skills, like French, filet crochet, and front flips. Curious.com. Grow your skills. Learn more at Curious.com/PRI.
To return to something we spoke about at the beginning of the program, Jon Stewart isn't the only one who can lay claim to revolutionizing television in the last decade. Netflix, the company, has done pretty well. The success of binge-watching, live-streaming, House of Cards, Orange is the New Black, has made Netflix a media player to rival the networks, the cable companies, and the Hollywood studios all at the same time. Carl Icahn, the investor wizard, made $1 billion this year off of an early bet that Netflix was on the right track on a number of tracks. Would investors feel the same way about Netflix's latest transformative gesture? This week's Netflix announced that it will be offering a generous leave policy for new mothers and fathers. For a full year after the birth or adoption of a new child, Netflix employees will get their full pay and as much time off as they need. This employee benefit, if widely adopted, would radically change the American workplace with implications for families, for health care, and the entire corporate bottom line. For now, such a leave policy, though, is just a dream for nearly all U.S. workers.
This is Ethan Nima from Augusta, Georgia, and I feel like people should be required to offer 3 months maternity leave. To return to work just after 6 weeks is plain out unhealthy for the mom and for the child. Maternity leave or flexibility in working from home or part-time after giving birth should be a major job choice factor for privileged Americans.
Why just privileged Americans? And why are American workers so behind workers in other industrialized nations regarding family leave policies, behind Estonia, Lithuania, Slovakia, and Bulgaria, among others? Of the 34 countries in the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, the U.S. is the only one with no legally mandated paid maternity leave. And 88% of American women get nothing, paid nothing, in the days after they give birth. Kay Heimowitz is a fellow at the Manhattan Institute and author of Manning Up, How the Rise of Women Has Turned Men into Boys. She's here. That's a provocative enough premise in and of itself. But what do you think about this Netflix proposal? Is it a kind of an Oprah gesture, you know, giving your employees a car or the people in your audience a car? Or is it laying down a gauntlet for the rest of the U.S. economy?
Well, I think it's mostly just business savvy, actually, for Netflix. A lot of people are celebrating this, and I think understandably so. I mean, I'm ready to send off a resume right now. If I could figure out a way to make myself interesting to the Netflix employers. But
you're not telling your family you're pregnant.
No, nor do I expect.
Exactly.
But at any rate, it's certainly a very appealing package that they've laid in front of their employees. You can basically have it your way. You have a baby. You can take off 3 months, go back part-time for a while, go back then full-time. You can do any kind of mix and match that you want and still get full pay. That's kind of amazing. And I do think that it sets the bar higher, but only for certain kinds of elite companies. I mean, this is not going to be able to, this is not something that's going to be, we're going to be able to trickle down to low-level employees.
Well, Netflix, of course, is flush with cash. They're doing very well, as I mentioned. But nevertheless, does this suggest that millennials will have a different expectation about family leave than our generation or the generation before us even.
Yeah. Well, I think educated millennials for sure. It's really important to understand the economics behind this. I mean, Netflix is trying to attract the highest level, the most competitive, the most motivated workers they possibly can. And so they could raise the salary level, but this is even more appealing to a lot of younger workers these days. And that's what they're trying to do is to make sure that they are at the first place that a lot of people in the tech industry want to look. So it makes a lot of business sense for them. It doesn't make business sense for a lot of other companies.
So Netflix can basically attract employees with a policy that might even be cheaper than offering salaries, getting involved in salary wars with other companies. But you don't think this can work outside of tech?
Oh, I do. I think that there are certain elite companies that can do this. But it's all about, again, competing for top talent. These companies are trying to figure out ways to not just attract but to retain top talent, particularly women. And by the way, notice that a lot of these perks are coming from the tech industry, and they're very appealing to women, these perks, of course, the maternity leave in particular, because the tech industry has been accused, as you know, of being not very female-friendly. So this has that going for it as well. But other companies who are trying to lure top talent will try to keep up. There's no question there's a kind of maternity-paternity arms race going on now, and that's a good thing for people at the very top.
Can employees in other industries advocate for this kind of change or even something close to it to get the United States more in line with countries around the world? And is there even a global competition going on in the sense that if U.S. companies offered more progressive leave policies, we'd be in a better position to get better employees in all industries?
Well, I don't really think that the competition when it comes to lower level service industries, for instance, is very great because it's very it's a very local economy. In other words, if a fast food or restaurant wants to hire people in New York City, they're not competing with people in Denmark. So when it comes to top-level talent, by the way, you are competing internationally, and that changes the whole equation for workers. But it also changes the equation for payments. So when you have people who are getting very low wages, they're not really in a position to bargain. Frankly, they're quite interchangeable. Mm. It's different at the top.
Why in America culturally do we have this sense that families don't matter, that this kind of leave policy is outrageous, would be a break on the economy?
I think that's the wrong way to frame it. I don't think it's that we're saying families don't matter. I think what Americans traditionally have sought after is a much more state-level or local-level policy. We are a much, much bigger country than any of the countries that you could cite that have these very, very elaborate paternity and maternity leaves. And our industries are also much more varied, so that the needs of those businesses are quite different. And the hope, which is not obviously always coming true, is that the individual states, localities, and industries will work this out the best they can. Now, that works, as we see, at the highest level, but not elsewhere.
Thanks, Kay.
Thank you.
Kay Heimowitz is a William E. Simon Fellow at the Manhattan Institute and author of Manning Up: How the Rise of Women Has Turned Men into Boys. And before we go, some more of you say farewell to Jon Stewart. Jason in Syracuse, New York told us, even as a conservative, I felt that Jon Stewart wasn't afraid to shine an honest light on anyone, regardless of political leanings. I will miss him and will follow him in his future endeavors. Indian Head, Maryland. Jon, first and foremost, thank you. I did not grow up like my parents did with news anchors you could trust. I've never known a Walter Cronkite. That is who you are for my generation, a man who cared more about accuracy and integrity than ratings. P.S. I also laughed. Thank you.
Janet Peterman from Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. Jon, you have inspired us to keep caring when our cynicism would make us turn away in disgust. whether from our government, our leaders, or members of the media. You have wept with us and gathered us together to laugh out loud and to shout and to lift our sights to a more noble standard of life. We thank you.
Well, thank you, Janet. She was talking about John Stewart. Oh, John Stewart, right, of course. Goodbye, John. We'll certainly miss you. Thanks so much for listening to our program. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by Citrix, creator of GoToMeeting, connecting people and businesses in face-to-face online meetings from any device, featuring a personalized meeting room for a custom look. Learn more at GoToMeeting.com. The Henry Luce Foundation, for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. The Takeaway's resilience reporting is supported by the Rockefeller Foundation. For more, go to rockfound.org.